From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the July 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Sound and Vision. Bletchley Park is alive with things to see and hear this summer, and in this episode we'll take you to a dance, meet an innovative artist, and hear from an erstwhile clerk from the Foreign Office who thought she was going to be a spy. Mary Kenyon worked in Hut 6, collating and organising vital messages alongside Asa Briggs and Boris Karloff's niece. She thought she was in for a much more glamorous posting than the dark wooden huts of the secret intelligence operations squirreled away in the Buckinghamshire countryside, but she knuckled down and soon made friends and lasting memories. And we meet an artist who's been inspired by the many layers of the Bletchley Park story. Sally Annett takes up this theme in a new exhibition, along with the ways in which the operation was fragmented, and its story remains so today. But first, a hot summer Saturday was the perfect setting for a swing dance on the lawn at Bletchley Park. Couples rolled up, many in 1940s fashions, and swung a mightily efficient shoe to help Bletchley Park in its attempt to sashay into the record books. Let's take a look back at how the day unfolded. I guarantee you'll be tapping your toes.
It's going to be brilliant tonight.
Hello, I can help you over. Hello.
Oh, hello, darling.
Hello.
Looking good.
Welcome to Bletchley Park.
Thank you. I haven't been for so long. It's great to go.
So are you the lead dancer?
Actually, it'll be you, won't it? You're doing boy.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay. We'll switch a room.
Yeah. Cool.
You are a couple. Yay, sit. Lead gets the A.
Oh, yeah.
Follower gets the B.
Thank you very much.
And here is a brush.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Have a wonderful time. Oh, pin your numbers on your backs.
Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
My name is Paulina Sipinska, and I'm an official Guinness World Records adjudicator.
So do you go to a lot of events, a lot of different events? I mean, this is probably nothing out of the ordinary. You probably go to a lot of things which a lot of people might find strange, but to the people involved, they're not at all, and they are valid records, aren't they?
Yeah, I attend probably about 2 attempts a week on average. So most recently, I adjudicated the largest parade of Suzuki motorcycles. Almost 1,000 motorcycles got together and had to drive in a parade formation. Another attempt I did was the most UAVs airborne simultaneously, where over 1,000 drones went up in the sky, and they actually created the Olympic rings, an image of a snowboarder, and it was played at the Olympic opening ceremony.
Oh, wow. Are you finding there's more and more different attempts now?
I think there's always been variety with the attempts people have done. I've never attended the same record more than once. I've attended similar records, so I've been to many dance record attempts, but never the largest swing dance lesson. So today I'm going to be making sure that all of the rules are followed. So with every record attempt, there's a set of guidelines, and I will be making sure that first and foremost, the minimum requirement is beat, but also that people are following the rules. So I have a specialist witness here today who's going to be ensuring that the proper lesson plan is followed and that, in fact, everyone is swing dancing.
Yeah.
And we also have stewards here, which are overlooking smaller groups to make sure that everyone's fully participating at all times. The lesson must last 30 minutes, so we'll be making sure that everyone's participating for the 30 minutes and they don't leave. And then there's also going to be a performance at the end, so everyone must partake in that as well.
Has this attempt been tried before?
This is actually a new record attempt. So specifically for swing dance, it's the first lesson of this type. However, there's so many lesson attempts and lots of dance records as well. So,
well, good luck and thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's my privilege to announce the very first act of today. Stomp your feet and clap your hand for the John Petters Swing Band.
Hello, I'm Sandy from Swing Dance MK.
I think we could really call you Sandy, our resident dance teacher at Bletchley Park, shouldn't we, really?
Oh, if that could be so, I hope so. I've done quite a few events here and really want to continue to do so.
Because you and your team come to all the 40s weekends events that we hold, and you do demos and then you do lessons.
In the breaks, yeah.
Why swing dance?
Oh my goodness me, swing dance. Unless you've tried it, that's a really, really good question. Everybody who's tried it can answer that question because it just is so much fun. And I know that's a cliche, but just give it a go and it fills you with joy, makes you smile. The music is wonderful and it's all coming back from the swing era and the jazz era. And it's so social. You meet so many people and have such fun doing it.
I mean, that was one of the things that got me at our recent 40s weekend. The people getting up to do the lessons, because you were getting sort of 20, 30 people at a time to do a lesson, and you run them through a little 5-minute, 10-minute lesson. Yeah. And at the end of it, they could do a little routine, couldn't they?
They could, yeah.
And the smiles on their faces.
Yeah. I mean, it's priceless, isn't it? It's a huge achievement. And a lot of people think it looks difficult, but you can just get up and do it with the right encouragement and the right context. It's very easy to pick up those basic steps and really get a sense of achievement when you've danced something through.
And you do this full time?
I do. I do a little bit of teaching in schools. I do a bit of supply and a bit of work for some sports partnerships doing dance in schools. But this is my main job now because I'm very passionate about swing dance.
You love it, don't you?
I do. Yeah. I love it, but I love the people and I love seeing people enjoy it. That's my main motivation, is just watching everybody have a great time.
Do you run lessons and workshops?
We do. We have 5 or 6 classes each week along with events, sometimes even 7, depending on what's going on. If you want to join us, you can look at the website, which is swingdancemk.com. We're on Facebook, so go onto Facebook, see our page, like it, and you'll get all the notifications. And you can also register with us on the website, and I'll send you a newsletter so you can hear all about it.
It's getting more and more popular, isn't it?
It's really growing. I mean, in London, it is massive, and I think that will just spread throughout the UK and onwards. And we are going to hit the 20s again in a couple of years' time. So that's where it all started. So that's going to be a huge, huge acceleration of interest in swing dance and jazz at that point.
Brilliant. Well, good luck with the record attempt.
Yeah, we're going to do it.
Hello, I'm Tim Franks, and I'm 001A, which I'm very pleased with.
Hi, I'm Melody Appleby, and I'm 001B.
So, I couldn't help but notice those two numbers, 1A and 1B.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you two were at the front of the queue then?
Well, sort of by accident. Yeah, we were. I mean, I was absolutely determined to get 001A, so I kind of elbowed my way. And then there was loads of other sort of couples and stuff coming in. And then Melody came in, 001B, and there it is, all from there. Brilliant.
So I'm guessing you love swing dance.
I love it, yeah. I mean,
this I love it. This is the first time I've ever done it.
Oh, really? So I'm hoping you've got a good teacher.
So I've got a fabulous teacher.
We've done a little crash course. We've done a sort of tiny, I'm going to tell you as much as I can about swing dancing in 3 minutes. kind of thing. And she was great. She was really, really good.
So do you think you're going to be part of a world record?
Yeah, definitely.
And the smiles on your faces, you love this, don't you?
Oh, yeah, no, I love it. I mean, what's not to love? I love this music. It's full of joy. It's full of joy. And I love this dancing. It's great.
He's a tramp, but I love him. Breaks a new heart every day. He's a tramp, he's a good one. I only hope he'll stay that way. He's a tramp, he's a scoundrel. He's a rounder, he's a cat. He's a tramp, but I love him. I wish he'd stay that way.
My name's Charlotte and I'm from Jive Swing.
And my name's Joseph and I'm the founder of Jive Swing.
So, today, special event. Going to try and break a world record.
We are indeed.
Absolutely. We're very excited and there's been a lot of social media activity, a lot of excitement among the swing dance community and the public. We're really excited.
So we're going to break that record.
You are, aren't you?
I can
see the looks on your face. You both.
We're ready to go.
You're both grinning in readiness to receive that award, aren't you?
For sure.
Definitely. It's a goal. When we sat down with the Big Ideas team, they said if they could just get 500 people, then that would
be
enough.
Happy, yeah.
But I think we... mention that actually we need to shoot for the moon, and if we miss it we'll definitely land amongst the stars and exceed that goal
for sure. Yeah.
So why swing dance for you two?
Swing dance is a passion. It's a passion, it's a way of life for many people. And Frankie Manning, one of the innovators and the ambassador of the dances back in the 1920s and 30s, he always said it was a happy dance. And
full
for us,
energy and excitement and everyone just forgetting the troubles of the day and just listening to that music. When that swing music comes on, you can't do anything apart from smile, I think.
And it's taken us back to a bygone era.
Yeah.
A bygone era where people were just pulling together and just having a great time at what possibly ordinarily may not have been a great time.
A lot of our veterans we interview, one of the things that comes up time and time again is them finishing a shift and jumping on a train, getting down to London, dancing the whole night away, getting the milk train back in the morning to come in for another shift. And that was during the war. So, yeah, that was their enjoyment. And it's still enjoyment now, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, when we talk to some of the old-timers and they tell us a time when even when some of the bands were sent in to entertain the army troops to boost morale and so forth, that is still the same today. And we celebrate the fact that many people come through the doors of Jive Swing in all the counters that we operate, and it's nice to see people that have come in with maybe troubles. They've met friends, people have met their husbands, they've met their wives, people have met friends that they ordinarily wouldn't have met other than being at one of our Jive Swing events and go on holiday with each other. It's inclusivity. We get everyone included, black, white, Asian, male, female,
ranges,
all ages.
Everyone just dances together.
It's just social, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. The social aspects. Many people sometimes come for the dancing, but I think the social dance
they
of what
they stay
the,
for their friendships.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're all over the world, aren't you?
Well, we've talked and performed all over the world, from USA throughout Europe. And
even places such as Israel, we've travelled there. There's a huge Lindy Hop scene. It's really spread worldwide.
We've been also fortunate of helping a number of countries with their very first swing dance classes that have now grown and exceeded beyond belief. So it's and we're still travelling, but we enjoy it. It's a passion, and you can't beat a passion.
How many years have you been doing this?
A long time, a long time. I'd say I've been a very long time, over 20 years.
Well, it's obviously kept you looking very fit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Apart from the oil of Ule.
Well, good luck with the attempt.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hopefully see you in the dance itself.
So leaders, raise your right hand.
Followers, raise your right hand.
Excellent. Okay, so we're going to start with a nice rhythm. And I want you to say the words with me. I want everyone to tap on their left foot. And we're going to go tap. And say tap. 5, 6, 7, and
tap.
5, 6, 7, and
tap.
Now this time, we're going to say step. Same foot. 5, 6, 7, and
step.
So we're going to put both bits together. We're going to go tap,
tap,
step. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Tap, step.
Nice and loud.
Tap, step.
Sing it like you're proud.
Tap.
Okay. We're going to try it with music.
Woo!
Here we go.
once you ever want to, bend your knees and relax. We're going to get the bounce. We're getting 5, 6, on your own. And
tap, tap, step, roll and
sing it. And
tap, step, roll and back.
Give yourself a massive round of applause. Announcements. Dup, dup. But for now, guys, dance and have fun. Once again, hug your partner and say, we did it! And now, it's time for the results. I'd like to bring on stage the Guinness official representative, Paulina, and a representative of Bletchley, Poppy.
Hello, everyone. I hope you had fun. It gives me great pleasure to be here today at Bletchley Park Trust for the largest swing dance lesson. The minimum to break this record was 125 couples. It was a valid attempt. Today, we had a total of 391 couples, which means that this is a new Guinness World Records title. Congratulations. Congratulations, you are officially amazing.
Hello everyone, I just wanted to say a quick thank you to everyone that has helped us, to our amazing hosts, Jive Swing, that have made it a blast for everyone, to the Bletchley Park staff and volunteers for helping myself and my team out, I know we've not been the easiest, to St John's that have been here to help with any accidents, and of course the amazing RAF Holton for being our stewards, they definitely made it possible. And to everyone else that helped out, of course, Guinness and all our amazing adjudicators, thank you, all of you, for taking part, because we wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise. Thank you.
And can you put your hands together for the CEO of Bletchley Park?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, thank you all for coming. And I'm not going to hold you away from the bar or indeed getting home, but just to really say one further vote of thanks. Poppy and her team. Guys, come on up here. Just under a year ago, I put a call out for some volunteers from across the organisation to come together and create an event, a big wow. These guys took time out from their day jobs and worked long and hard to come up with this idea and then take it to fruition. And to break a world record is a fantastic achievement. So please put your hands together for the whole team. And whilst it's invidious to pick out any individual, I must pick out Poppy, who, as the most junior member of this team, has project managed this effort. And what an effort for somebody so junior in the organisation. Poppy, well done. Team, thanks very much. You've done us proud. Everybody, thanks for coming. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Don't forget, we have a birthday today. It's Alan Turing's birthday. So we're going to sing happy birthday. Are you ready? 1, 2, 3. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for the John Petters Swing Band!
My name's Scott Marshall.
I'm Kirsten Ball.
We've just had 390-odd couples dancing, learning and dancing for 30-odd minutes. Probably went on for about 40 or 50 minutes at the end. We've just found out we won. And you two are still dancing.
Yeah.
Have you had a good night?
Very.
Yeah. Had a lot of fun. Yeah. Even if we didn't get it perfectly, we were laughing, yeah, trying to get it right.
But I think that's everyone I talk to about swing dance, that's the thing, isn't it? It's as much about taking part. It's not, you've got to be a brilliant dancer, it's just the fun, isn't it?
For our first time as well, it's intense to get away straight away.
Really? So
yeah.
It was really good fun.
Yeah.
But you're both obviously into the 40s and 50s, but yeah, you both look amazing. I bet this is your first swing dance.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're going to be booking lessons soon.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
And also now, when you go and book lessons, you'll be able to tell them you're a record breaker.
Yeah, that is a very good feeling.
Thanks very much.
My name's Poppy, I work at Bletchley Park and I'm currently the project manager of the Big Ideas team that created the world record that we have today.
So we could lie and say we've recorded this interview before we've got the announcement, but I think people will be able to even hear the smile on your face because we have just found out that we've won. You've been working on it a long time, haven't you?
Long time, yeah. We've been working on it since about November, but we had this idea in January. Since then it's been go, 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 getting it all ready.
What made you pick this event?
We just wanted something that would get people excited, you know, something that is fun, everyone's happy, going to enjoy themselves, and you know, this was it, swing dance. It's iconic 1940s dancing, and so just to give a chance for this generation to, you know, try it out and give a new thing a go, then it was a brilliant idea. Yeah,
and it does put a smile on everyone's face, doesn't it?
Well, definitely, yeah. So I've seen tonight. There's so many smiles all around.
Well, you've had a worried look on your face for a lot of the evening, but you have been project managing this and you've done a brilliant job. Everyone here is really proud of what you've done, but now finally you're smiling because you've had the result and we got the world record.
Yeah, we got the world record. It was 391 couples, so nearly 800 people. But yeah, it was my whole team. We've all been working so hard on this, myself included, but yeah, all of us have just been working so hard and we're so glad we've done it.
And now you can go and have a Pimm's and relax.
I'm going to have a pint of Pimm's. That's what I'm going to do.
Well done, Poppy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for talking to me.
Okay, I'm Debbie. I'm Julie.
I'm Terry.
I'm Steve.
So I've got four very smart people here who, believe it or not, are still standing after dancing for about 50 minutes. What's it feel like to be record breakers?
Quite
exhausting.
Exciting.
Fantastic.
Very exciting.
Now, be honest, did you manage to dance all the way through the lesson?
Of course.
Yeah,
of course we did.
Yeah, managed. Yeah.
We wrestled a little bit.
Have you had a good day?
Oh, it's been brilliant.
It's been lovely.
You've been to Bletchley before?
Yes.
Are you from around here?
Yes.
We walked.
That's why you can have a drink.
It's been a great event. Really brilliant event.
Yeah, it has.
Fantastic. Yeah, well done.
And you can tell everyone on Monday that you're a world record holder.
Sounds good, that, doesn't it?
I know.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mary Kenyon had visions of being a beautiful spy in Valparaiso when she was called up to a mysterious-sounding job at the Foreign Office in 1943. But she was sent to Bletchley Park, where she collected and collated messages, working alside the luminary codebreaker Asa Briggs. Mary recalled her vital war work in Hut 6 when she told her story to Bletchley Park's Oral History Project.
So, Mrs. Kenyon, can you please tell me what you were doing before Bletchley Park?
Yes. I was at Tilson High School. I was school captain, and I wanted to do an English degree, and I was called up after 2 years. My generation was the only generation called up. There were various categories, medicine and teaching and some science subjects who did a proper degree course, but we did a course dealing out. I left out Anglo-Saxon, and we got what's called a wartime degree, as opposed to men who did Part A, then went back after the war if they wanted to do Part B.
And where was this, please?
This was Hunville College, Oxford.
Oh, right.
I was there for 2 years, 41 to 43.
Yeah.
And in 43, when we knew we were all going to be called up, I thought I'd probably get into the services. Mm. Anyhow, a lieutenant called Harold Fletcher, rather handsome. I believe he was a lance corporal. You probably know about him. He's in various things. Who was a personnel man at Hut 6. Came round and talked to us and said there was a very important job going at the Foreign Office. And some of us, being naive, thought we might be beautiful spies in Valparaiso. this was not so. So some of us put ourselves down and I was chosen, and a friend of mine called Lorna Bottomley, were told to report, I think, to the 308 train from Euston and come down. And there were, I think, six other people, one from Cambridge, one from Edinburgh, one from Glasgow, one from Belfast, and one from LSE, all of whom I became great friends with and remained, all my life I've remained friends with them all. And on the whole, with a number of other people from Bletchley. Anyhow, we came down the train, and we all went in and signed the Official Secrets Act. Now here, just as you were suggesting, I may have put the gun on the table now because I've read about it so frequently, but I cannot remember for certain, but I do know that I signed the Official Secrets Act. The next thing to do was to find a billet, and though I realised afterwards that the great thing to do was to sit on the billeting officers and eat. I didn't realise it at the time. And I was sent to Wolverton. We paid 21 shilling. I think my initial salary was £214, something like that, a year. But we paid 21 shillings to the militor, who was told to provide two meals. But as we were on shift, it might be at any time. The whole of the sitting room was taken up by a Morrison shelter, and they slept underneath it. There were two or three bedrooms above, which, as far as I could tell, nobody ever used at all. Anyway, I had one of the bedrooms above. Nobody had ever seen anybody so extraordinary as me before. So the three children and the owner of the house, they didn't want us. They didn't want me anyway, because they'd never seen anyone so strange. And I said, at mealtime, I was eating at different times, so I sat in a corner, and they all sat on the Morrison shelter and watched me. It was just like being at the zoo. And after a bit, friends and relations came too. So there's quite a crowd of people sitting on the Morrison shelter watching me eat at various times. I did this for some months. I drew, it was a silly thing to do, but I did draw a picture to send to my parents. I put it in a drawer in my bedroom, and I didn't think she ever went in there. Anyway, she found it, so Morris, next day, the billeting officer, got in touch with me and said, I'm down Bletchley Park, etc. And I'm sorry to say that, well, to some degree, I suppose I had. But I didn't think she was going to find the pic.
So what was the picture?
The picture was all the people sitting on the Morrison shelves watching me have my stew in a corner. Anyhow, when you go into the gates, on the left-hand side, there was the canteen and the hall, and still there, as far as I remember. On the other side, it was colloquially called the Naughty Girls' Homes. Oh, it was not its actual thing.
Yes.
They were called the hostels. Mm. And they were run by a lady, perhaps you better not know the names.
Go on.
Mrs. Bristow. Mm. Mrs. Bristow was in love with a new American colonel who lived at Tring. There was more of this as time goes on. Anyhow, in the hostels, which were really meant for young girls who did menial tasks, but they're as nice as pie, and they're infinitely more sophisticated than I was, anyhow. And you had tiny little compartments all the way along the Nissen Hut. I can't remember how many people we had, about 16 in Nissen Hut, but you had your own privacy. It was no bigger, more or less that desk there, which you got a little bed on one side and a cupboard, and you had your own window, and it was absolutely gorgeous. I can only tell you that it was paradise living there after having lived where I was before, so I couldn't have been more happy. Each Nissen Hut was looked after by... See, all these ladies were fearfully old, probably 39 or 40. one in charge of me was a drunk, but she was a nice spy, but she never looked after anybody at all. Now, because the people at Tring, who used to come over to dance, and we had Glenn Miller, and because it was just across the road, the naughty girls, including me at that time, went across the road and danced. But the Americans wanted us back. They're based to dance there, so they sent a bus. And on one occasion, the bus was supposed to leave, and it might be at 10. You appreciate we were working shifts, so you could only go according to whatever shift it was. You told the time on the bus and had left beforehand. So the idea was insalubrious, shall I say, but it was all right because some of us fought and they came back on the milk train. Mm. But there was really no supervision. But sadly, I was moved out, not doing anything nefarious on this occasion, but some of us were moved out to Woburn Sands, where there were five of us in a room. So somebody on one shift was always asleep when the others were coming and going. But it was a nice pub, and it's probably still there. You probably know it, I don't know. It was surrounded by woods. We used to go for walks. First time I saw glowworms. So there were all sorts of things which one did. When I was at the hostels, there were lots of things to do, and there were remarkably good reviews and plays because of all the people who were there. There was a lot going on, poetry group, the music thing, the choir, and we sang Rio Grande there. I remember, I think it was the first presentation. Mm. The chap who conducted became BBC Electric Music, I presume. And, of course, when we were in the hostel, we ate at the canteen. And I know people said nasty things about the canteen, but considering they had to have hot meals and something night and day for 24 hours, person, I thought it was okay. Mm. And we met people from other places at these activities. I only mention this just to show that we did not know what people did. There was somebody called Peter Twin, who was really quite important. I mean, fairly old, like about 25, I think. and I did go out and meals with him, but I had no idea what he did, and it was not until I saw his photograph in one of the things that I knew that he was really very important. We just didn't talk about it. Woburn Sands, I suppose I was there perhaps for 6 months. It was entirely female. We were terribly excited when a lot of sports bags came from somewhere or other. It was Captain Somebody. And he turned out to be a tiny little man with a little droopy moustache and absolutely useless to all of us. We were desperately disappointed. I can only tell you why he was chosen. Well, being quite, I suppose, without danger to us all. Anyway, there he was. And I'm sure many people have told you this, that there was no rank at all. I mean, if that's a sir, he was Lance Corporal, I think. But there'd be other people who would be captain, or anything like that. You know, absolutely nothing at all. I've no idea what it was like outside, and I do know, as you know, that people in the services felt very uncomfortable sometimes. Or people not in the services found very, very uncomfortable. Some of the service people, like Harold Fletcher, he only wore his uniform when he was going on a train because you got it for free. After that, we looked around, and I was very lucky. A woman from Edinburgh and I managed to get into a house quite near Bletchley, within 10 minutes walk, easily. Again, a service family, three children, and Minty and I had the downstairs two front rooms. You could, from the front, you could see from the front door. I only say this because there was a rather horrendous picture of one of their great-grandmother or something over the fireplace. And I'm sorry to say we put a poster over it, but you could see it from the door, and it unsettled the owner. We did take it down and apologise, and it was very silly of us. However, I think we paid 25 shillings each for that one. You provided your own food too. But because my parents lived in the country, they did send things up, and Mrs. Kopeck, whom I do remember as such, benefited slightly from my parents on that occasion. And we were there till the end of the war. And opposite lived Kerris. As I say, we were all friends together. I really cannot at this moment remember any unpleasant argument. There were all sorts of different people there, some of whom attained notoriety afterwards, like Boris Karloff's niece was in my room. Later on, she murdered her children. You know, it was a fearful shock. And people were disorientated by working in Bletchley. They really were. When I went to Coventry, I was in the same hotel as the doctor who was in charge of the loony bin, which was attached to Bletchley. And she told me how many cases there were. It was partly the atmosphere. It was the very bright lights. Neon lights. You had blackout curtains. And those blast walls down below. Thinking about it later on, I couldn't think why we had to have light on the whole time. It was obviously because anybody could look in and you could see anything, obviously, because it was so bright. You had that. You had dust, because it was very seldom cleaned. Bits of paper and mess all over the floor. And, of course, it was concrete and bits of dust came up and all over us. And it smelled. It was very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. And particularly, we all had eye trouble. Some people had really bad eye trouble. I remember someone called Elaine Dent had, I mean, they swirled, they looked like myxomatosis almost. It was very unpleasant. But for security reasons, it had to be as it was. And people like Angus Wilson, who was at the BM, wasn't he? British Museum. I mean, he was not in my hut personally, but I did know him slightly, and he really was potty. I mean, he went on being potty, because when I used to go to BM occasionally and to see him, and he went on being potty. But if you were that way inclined, it emphasised the situation. And it was the noise. And you had to do it fast, else there was no point. But in general, we did all right.
You were very young, so I suppose that helped. But,
I'm sure it did.
Yes, I'm sure it did.
We were young.
Yes.
And we played squash. Played squash. Squash courts were good.
Well, they had Bletchley Park squash courts.
No, they were along the road. They weren't past the church. I can't remember quite how I got there. But you could walk easily enough. They were fine. I'd have been taken down to Donkey's years ago.
Did you ever use the famous tennis courts at Bletchley Park?
Yes. I mean, they're in constant use. But then you had to go across them to get to various places. I can't remember going boating. I did boating at Oxford.
On the lake at Bletchley Park?
Yes, I think so. But the other thing, of course, was the constant traffic, which I don't think people realised. It had to be. Other people would have told you about this, but dispatch riders, fannies, buses, It was like Piccadilly Circus the whole time. Mm. And if you wanted a quiet life, it certainly drove you mad, I think.
Can you tell us now about the work you were doing in Part 6?
Thoroughly dull stuff.
but your part in it, really, rather than what Part 6 as a whole did. Because I think we understand
I'm sure
that.
We understand that.
Yeah, so how it all fits together with the people like you doing all the work. Yeah.
Yes, well, the stuff came in great shoots. You know that. Mm. Do you know about kittening?
I've heard the term, but if you could explain it, please, yes.
Well, the stuff came in... Mostly Air Force women, WAFs, getting it down, and then it all came down in a great chute. Anyway, the stuff had come down, it had been taken by, like, monitors in a way. I mean, it was all school stuff to some degree. And according to what you had been allocated that day, well, I believe at the beginning, each call sign, obviously, had a colour key. They ran out of colours fairly soon. And Part 6 did Army and Air Force, as you know. The Army, I think, had animals, badgers and things like so on, and the Air Force had birds. No, it was the other way around, which is so extraordinary. Supposing I was given Kingfisher, I would be doing an Army key, but you would know what call sign it was. On the list, you had to put that down, and you had to look to see if there were any mistakes, inequalities, and that sort of thing. You had heaps of these things, and you had to go through each one as it came in to see if there was any similarity between the first one and the second one and the third one, whatever you had.
When you say similarity, you mean in the call sign?
In the call sign, yes. Or anything, yes. If there was anything peculiar.
All the groups of letters?
Yes. You know it came out in five groups.
Yes, yeah.
The watch, who were grand, really, like Ace of Briggs, and they had a little cubicle on one side, and they walked round, and you pointed it out as they came. And if there was an irregularity, because occasionally the call sign people used friends' names twice or whatever, and you knew much more from that, how you could start doing the whole thing. Then went to the machine room, or the bomb section, which was run by Rems at the other end, and they tried it. This is before Colossus, obviously. Mm. Colossus came, really, in my last year, in 1944 or 1945, must have been. And then Minty and I were both taken into house, where we had an awfully grand room and a batman and a fire and everything. But we were doing much the same sort of thing. This was D-Day time, when things were needed. And we had that grandeur for a bit. And then we went back when things were more normal. Though, of course, they had to import a few more people, not very many more people, if I can recollect, after D-Day, because of all the things that were happening in France. Mm. We knew very little about anything. We knew it had happened, obviously, but we weren't given any particular indication ourselves of, you know, activities. Not very much at all. We benefited by German films that had been taken. I remember Baron Munchausen, the first film I ever saw in colour. Bits and pieces we got from things that were happening from over there. But we went on doing exactly the same sort of thing. As you know, we had a week off, but you could put one day on either side according to how work was going. Sometimes you didn't get a week off. It was never the same week. You had to, there was a chart, and you had to put your name down, and if you could get the time off, you got the time off. If we only had one day, I used to go to usually Oxford or Cambridge quite candidly for the day, in a rather solitary manner, I think. So, by 1945, I had accumulated a week off and a day on either side. And one of my friends was getting married in Sheffield, where she lived, to an American from the watch, because by now the Americans had joined the British in the watch. And it was going to be on May the 6th. And so one of them went up the train, stayed overnight, and Churchill's speech saying the end of the war with Europe was relayed at the wedding breakfast.
Wow.
And I went back home, and I remained there for the requisite 7 days, it must have been, and came back on the right day, and I was just not allowed in the park at all.
Really?
Nobody told me anything at all. I was barred by the armed guard, and they said, your hut has been burnt down. And it had. Well, at least it hadn't been burned down, but all the papers in here. But you know that.
Mm.
That scene was absolutely perfect, I understand, including bits and pieces, I think a handbag or something of mine, but you know, bits that I had left there. But nobody has said a word. I do think my friend Keris, my friend Minty might have written to me, perhaps they thought I knew. But they'd all gone, and I had to go back to my billet and tell poor Mrs. Kopeck that we no longer wanted to be there, and I had to pack up. And everything cried. It's the first time that I had seen anyone have a dessert spoonful of brandy out of a little bottle. She cried because the children had measles and, well, she wanted the money. And I felt awful about it, but there's nothing I could do. My parents sent her, sent her a chicken because we had hens and things. And I kept in touch for a little bit, but I have never forgotten her little face with a pink bow on her head, crying. And that was the end of Bletchley.
Gosh.
I think I got a thing saying I'd been all right or something, you know, like everybody did. I was offered a job at the Board of Trade because we were supposed to do that. I wanted to go abroad, I must say. I thought I'd like to do something exciting. My friend Keris had already got a job at Butterworth, the publishers. My parents heard of my friend Keris getting this job at Butterworth, the publishers. And they thought, what a nice job for little Mary, I regret to say. Anyhow, I managed to get myself a job in the colonial service, in fact, however, in East Africa. But my father was a churchwarden at a place called Langford. And William Foyle lived in a place called Beeley Abbey, and he used to the church. And he said, come talk to Christina. So I did. And she said, don't come and work at Foyle's. It's a terrible place to work at, which is true.
I worked there once.
Did you?
Yes.
No.
I was interviewed by Christina herself.
Well, really?
Between school and university.
Really?
They used to have little adverts in the Telegraph saying people, you know,
Yes.
I'll do that. Yeah, yes.
Anyway, she said, there are one or two people who want somebody. I believe Jonathan Cape does. I just wrote to Jonathan Cape, who wrote back a very nice letter indeed, I must say. And he said that he placed a field, but Graham Greene wanted somebody. So I did write. They sent me, I think, a dozen manuscripts to review. And I had an interview. And then I became his assistant. So that was what I did. By pure chance, Mac, my husband, Paul Max.
So who exactly was that you were working for?
Graham Greene.
Graham Greene, well, right, yeah. Gosh. You, of course, like everyone else, kept quiet about Bletchley Park. So
yes.
Then all of a sudden, the story came out in 1974.
Yes.
Can you remember that? Were you shocked?
Yes, terribly. Mm. Terribly. I don't think even Max and I talked about it then. No, terribly. No, for years we were shocked. Other people said this too, and other people have been quite unable to talk about it at all. I think lives have moved on. My own life. Max's sister was married to a television cook called Philip Harpen. So, in a way, I got into that world as well, too. And I think Bletchley itself receded like a strange dream. And to some degree, until recently, I never even thought about it or anything very much, because though I have read books about it, I think possibly because of the film One Thing and Another, I have been asked, you know, to talk about it in this last year more than I have been talked about asked to talk about it ever, and it has come back to me. It could have been done in a way by anybody, but I presume we had all been vetted. I presume our backgrounds had been gone into, and I presume that was why we were chosen. And we were needed then, because I believe that the numbers went up colossally in 40. You know much more.
I know the size of Bletchley Park increased greatly around that time.
It did.
Because
they'd broken things.
They'd broken it. There was more to deal with, yes.
Yeah. So that was entirely why we were there. I may say some of the people who had gone into the services from Somerville turned up later on, so it might just as well have started off then. But I think all of us were much the same age and either had completed a degree or were in the middle of one. And I do remember going back, like the first time, because you know, you gave £100 or something, and then they ask you back, and there was a lot of press there, and they said, why didn't you tell anybody? And the simple answer was, because we wanted to win the war. Mm. I mean, it sounds sloppy, but it was a fact.
Yes.
So we didn't tell anybody. I can only say I had no doubt that people round about had suspicions, but everybody was very, they were very good. I never had any questions at all.
If you listened to last month's episode, you'll know all about the Bond at Bletchley Park exhibition, tracing Ian Fleming's connections with the secret intelligence operation during World War II, which inspired the character and some of his adventures. If you didn't, well, do. Artists were specially commissioned to create works inspired by the Bond stories and characters, and that's not the only new art exhibition at Bletchley Park this summer. Sally Annett is an artist whose vision is brought to life in another new exhibition in Block B. She explores the themes of fragmentation and layers as they apply to the way the Government Code and Cipher School was organised, and she makes a nod to the people whose contribution is not recorded in the Roll of Honour, because neither they nor their families have put their names forward. Let's hear from Sally about how she decided to tell the story in her own unique way. So tell me about this project.
The project is an Arts Council supported project which looks at works on paper. And I'm working with Bletchley Park and English Heritage at Rest Park, so two originally stately homes not very far apart in sort of the home counties, and looking at their uses throughout history and the use of paper in those organisations. So Rest Park houses all the wallpaper for English Heritage, including all the wallpaper from the GLC buildings that were taken down, knocked down in the 1980s. So that's one particular kind of paper. And then Bletchley Park has over 500,000 pieces of paper that are part of the archives and the intercepts and the messages. So there's a lot of social history tied up with that, either to do with presentation of culture or information and power, and that the word or the image are completely relevant today, even though we're computer technology has tried to supplant and possibly failed in some ways. So things like the signatures that went out on the top secret documents still affect our lives today. We're still very obsessed with image and interiors and homes. There's lots of power politics, lots of presentation of the English country home as very English, when in fact it's not. That sort of the myth of Britishness is very central to Bletchley Park, which is why I picked one of the themes of the roses. So the rose petals that I'm using to do the transfer engraving are picked in my village in France. So my French neighbours have collected this sort of very English rose symbol to be used, and it's not. And again, the text for the catalogue will be produced partly in French, partly in English, and we'll have Polish elements as well to reflect the really multinational inputs for Bletchley Park. And Rest Park has a very stunning collection of wallpapers in the building. So it has the Zuba wallpapers, which are French, and then big Chinese wallpapers, which are stunningly beautiful, but again, reflect the internationality. So in the prints, which you can't see because it's a sound interview, but they have specially created seals that refer to Japanese seals and paperwork. And I'm making a series of origami objects from the prints. So the prints will then go into 3D items and be suspended, which refers to the Japanese translation language. And although they weren't allies, obviously, but there's a big Japanese connection between both buildings.
So these prints, first of all, if I describe it, it's got intersecting circles and straight lines that form triangles, and it's quite sort of a mathematical formation of lines and shapes, but overlain with the imprints of, I suspect, rose petals?
Yes.
And it's fragmented and beautiful.
One of the main themes of the project has been fragmentation, and obviously at Rest, that's the fragmentation of the archaeological collection. We only have bits of history left, and those have been narrated in a very particular, very pro-British way, often. So this piece is based on, as you say, the circles that are in, that just repeat everywhere throughout the blueprints, the designs, the actual machines. I've spent quite a lot of time going through the paperwork. Whether it's a screw or a nut or a bolt or one of the bomb dials, it's there. And this design of the spinning wheel, the oldest examples, I think, are in religious scrolls. So they're in Hebrew ancient Hebrew codices, well, not that ancient, 16th century, and they have little, they're called vulvas, and they have knotted string dials, and they were used for exactly the same thing, and then that goes through into linen making and the music organ. You have this sort of function of paper. This is the first print, so it's the straightforward original engraved metal plate, and it has the image that I've designed. The print that you have highlighted, which has the fragmented pieces, is I have then re-inked the plate and positioned rose petals on the plate, printed that, which leaves an image that has a lot of white or absent patches from the original image. I then flip the rose petals back onto the copper plate and print it again. So you have a distorted image of the original over the top. So all the fragmented pieces are elements of the original plate. And that's looking at the code. So you have the triplicate indicators and you have pieces of code. So you have your original message, which is scrambled and then recoded. But often it doesn't make sense. Even if you have the best translation that you can, it's gone from one language to another and has transmuted. So all the prints like this have three stages, the original, the lift and the transfer. And the rose petals are perfect for that, with the symbolism of the rose, which is such a nationalistic thing, but then them being French. But they also bleed colour, but their texture is really like human skin. So it's very strong, it's very durable, and you couldn't do it with a tissue. If you did it with a piece of paper of heavier weight, you'd get an edge, or you'd get a completely different quality. And also the papers are scented. So when I'm working, I've got bowls and bowls of petals. I actually freeze them, because then if you freeze them when they melt, you know how strawberries squish in the freezer, the colour and the scent comes out better when you reprint it.
Can you tell me a bit about where and how this will all be displayed?
There will be two exhibitions, one at Rest Park, one at Bletchley Park. They will run in June and July of this year. It'll open in Rest Park, I think, on the 14th of June and be displayed in their dairy. So there'll be an installation of prints and paper in the dairy. Another framed prints will be inserted into the collections. I'm also putting very large metal panels in the garden, so bringing interiors outside. So I'll use details from the wallpapers and blow them up to probably a metre by a metre and have them sited in the rose garden. So I've made three A2 size books of the prints. So there will be one book which has the original printed plates, a second book which has the lifts, so has missing parts, and then the third book will be the final sort of recoded book. And they will be available for the public to look and handle at Rest. I don't know whether in Bletchley we'll be able to let people actually handle the items. So there's a lot of different outputs, and I'll be running workshops and giving a couple of lectures whilst I'm here as well.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy. Write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.